This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little last season Prada she's a me, honey.
John Callier, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curl?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we're celebrating the Mardi Gras Film Festival with a guest-studded lineup. So we're beginning by running through the festival, this year's really exciting program with festival director Lisa Rose. And next we're speaking to two filmmakers. We're speaking with Miko Michaela, who is the director of A Moment in the Reeds, one of only a handful of queer films from Finland, and a really kind of interesting take on the kind of God's Own Country plot line. And then, of course, we're speaking with the producer of Boys for Sale, Ian Thomas Ash. Boys for Sale is a documentary that takes us to the underground sex work industry in Japan and has some really interesting things to say about that industry. So it's going to be a jam-packed program as we celebrate and run through this year's Mardi Gras Film Festival.
Well, we're just about to start queer film festival season.
Our Christmas.
It is.
That lasts for weeks and weeks and weeks, because we kind of get a taste from Sydney because we're Melbourne.
That's right.
And then our free-to-air stations start delighting us with a few treasures. It just becomes...
And the ABC this year as well, going out of its way to spotlight some really remarkable stories.
Riot, I think, is the film they've gone at, well, the showcase they've gone and made.
And let's not forget Melbourne Queer Film Festival with the program launch. Tomorrow night.
I got my membership card in the mail just the other day. Very excited.
It's like unwrapping a Christmas. Through these programs is literally like unwrapping a Christmas present every year.
And that's what I'm curious to see where everyone starts in the program. What do you go and look for first? Do you go and look for a feature, an event? Do you go and look for a short? What do you look for in a... how do you put your little search category? Do you put a search category?
I don't search category. No. I'm very visual, Gina,
Yeah, I learned that earlier.
So I think that just gives it away.
Well, you see, I start at day one and work my way through to day end.
I go straight to what are the events.
So you like to start at the top and work your way to the bottom, don't you, Daniel?
Really?
I must admit, I'm exactly the same when it comes to a program guide.
We're not alluding to tops and bottoms.
Still talking about the program?
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I'm not going there.
There'll be a segue later to one of the films that we're talking about.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Right.
But
didn't realise that there was a certain trope that comes up in a lot of...
I was very surprised. Okay, I've missed something.
You haven't? Well, we're going to be unpacking what exactly you've missed when we talk about...
Clearly nothing
as
a lesbian.
Can I say, you've missed out on quite a bit. But we'll be talking about that when we look at A Moment in the Reeds, which of course is their film from Miko Michaela. And it's an interesting film. I mean, I think it got a bit unlucky with God's Own Country coming out last year, because it does take us to a very similar place, similar kind of story about a boy who's living under the rule of his father and trying to break away from that rule in the country. And then an immigrant comes and
kind of brings
himself out of himself, really. Yeah. A similar story, but it's very Finnish, isn't it, in its approach.
But I think it's in its defense. These two films were being made at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
So there really wasn't any crossover. This is not a Me Too. It just happens to be coincidental.
I hope so.
Did you say it's not a Me Too?
Well, what I mean
is... Me Too is in that.
No, no, no. As in a copycat film.
It's not a copycat. Me Too
these days. It's not a copycat.
I didn't say hashtag Me Too.
Okay. No,
exactly. I just said Me Too.
Yes.
I'm glad we got that out of the way.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, the other film we're spotlighting, I know both of you had really positive reactions.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
Boys for Sale.
Really difficult film to watch.
Yeah.
But I was completely immersed in the story the entire way.
Mm.
Difficult, but yeah, lovely.
Well, you know, there's a special place in my heart for the Mardi Gras Film Festival because it does, as you say, it opens up. Everyone's talking about award season now in Hollywood, but for us, it opens up our queer cinema season here in Australia.
It's like our Melbourne Thanksgiving before Christmas happens.
Right. It's just an exciting time of year. We have so many film festivals and we've got the Academy Awards and the award season in Hollywood. There's just so much going on with film. And the Mardi Gras Film Festival really kicks it all off, but it also kicks off Mardi Gras, and this year is a big year for Mardi Gras.
That's right. It's the 40th anniversary of Mardi Gras, and Cher is coming. Cher. Turn back time, Cher.
Really? Cher?
Did you say Cher or Cher?
Cher.
That's what I said.
Cher with your friends.
A little bit of Cher to kick off our Mardi Gras Film Festival celebrations this evening. We are, of course, spotlighting this really exciting film festival that kicks off queer cinema season here in Australia. And how could we not pay homage to Cher when she's, in fact, coming out for Mardi Gras?
I know, how exciting. You know what? That it almost made me buy a ticket to Mardi Gras this year.
Well, you couldn't. Didn't it sell out the moment the rumours started, and then when it was announced there was no tickets left?
Well, that's it, unless you're willing to pay absolutely through the nose. But who wouldn't want to go see Cher? I know some people who spend $400 to go see Celine Dion.
I wouldn't know anyone
like
that.
I know. Who would spend that kind of coin on Celine Dion?
She'll not be eating for the next, like, month.
Nor will Celine. But anyway.
But I think it's a fact universally acknowledged that Cher is a gay icon.
Diva of the screen and stage, and she is
Look, we've done Cher.
We've done Cher. We did a Cher show. But we want to know...
Cher, that's a time twister after all.
Well, we want to know what everyone's favourite Cher moment is. It doesn't have to be a film, but if it is, bonus points.
Yeah.
Let us know. Or are you like eagerly anticipating her next on-screen venture, which is of course Mamma Mia the Second.
Really?
Risky. Risky. Yeah. Mm. Her and Meryl on the screen again, reunited after Silkwood like some 30 years later. Mm. So was Silkwood your favourite Cher movie? Was it Moonstruck, the Academy Award winning Cher film? Or was it seeing her on screen with Maggie Smith in Tea with Mussolini, which like all of those divas on the screen together, you can't.
You're missing her being on screen with Winona Ryder in Mermaids. Come on, that is the best
Mask.
Cher film.
Oh, Mask. Or Cher on a Harley Davidson.
On the screen with Christina Aguilera in Burlesque. I mean, talk about top-notch cinema.
Well, anyway, message in and let us know your favourite Cher moment, whether it's film or song.
Or on a Harley Davidson in Mask. Mm. And Dykes on Bikes.
Messages in on...
The number's 0427JOY949. That's 0427569949. Or you can email us at onair@joy.org.au. And we're joined on the phone at the moment by festival director Lisa Rose. Lisa, we're going to kick off this evening by asking you, what's your favourite Cher moment? Is it a film? Do you have a favourite Cher film?
Cher on Twitter is pretty entertaining. It's a little bit crazy on Twitter. But no, for me, you can't go past Silkwood. She played a lesbian. Of course that's my favourite.
See, Cher on a Harley Davidson still Mask. It just, that's
this
my favourite.
This is shallow, but I like the 2 minutes that she had on Will and Grace, that little skit with Jack.
That was pretty good.
That was hilarious.
Okay.
Now, as much as we'd love to talk with you for the next 20 minutes about Cher and Cher alone, Lisa, tell us about this exciting program that you've put together. Is 39 films, is that right? 39 feature films.
No, 55.
Narrative.
Well, it's 40 narrative features. We added an extra one after the program went to print called My Days of Mercy because it's a huge new film starring Ellen Page, and I was trying to get it for months, and they didn't confirm until after I went to print. So I was like, well, I'm still going to play it anyway.
Better late than never.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's by far our fastest selling film for the ladies, which is not surprising. So there's 40 narrative features and there is 16 narrative documentaries, and we also have 12 shorts packages.
So this is more shorts packages than you've ever had before, isn't it?
I don't know if it's ever. I haven't gone back and looked through the 25 years of guides.
Why not?
But it probably is.
Yeah.
And we're one of the festivals probably in... I've done a lot of research over festivals overseas and stuff, and Australian festivals don't tend to play as many shorts packages as a lot of other international queer film festivals do. And I just, the quality of short films that I was watching, because I was watching all the shorts and all of the features, and they were just, the quality was so good that I just couldn't ignore it. I could have programmed more features, and then I just thought, well, these shorts are actually better than some of the features I was going to program. So I thought, I'm going to support those emerging filmmakers and play these films, and hopefully people will come along and see them and agree with me.
And that's the thing. These short packages are some of the best taste you actually do get from emerging filmmakers. And it just gives people such a variety of story, because shorts, you know, it can be made in a year. A feature film can be made in 7 years. So it's usually really current stories that we're seeing on screen.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Although I wonder, do you worry as a, obviously bums on seats is really important. Are people a bit slower to buy tickets to a short film?
I think they sell out, don't they? Oh, no, really?
Well, it kind of depends. Like I've been recommending, look, we have one that's called Hot Boy Shorts.
That sells out quickly, does it?
It's a marketing fail on my part.
Alan has bought all of the tickets to that one.
He's flying up to Sydney for that.
Exactly. And the image we've used is quite provocative. So that obviously is like, you know, flying out the door. But yeah, no, I mean, it does. But I mean, they're also, from a financial perspective, that to be perfectly frank, they're a lot cheaper for us to be able to screen them as well. The market for feature films is changing so dramatically over the last few years. I've been associated with Queer Screen for 5 years now. Festival director, this is my first Mardi Gras Film Festival as festival director, though. But the price we have to pay for films now is... it's been influenced very much by the fact that there's so many more films getting distribution in Australia and also so many more films being played in mainstream festivals. Like Sydney Film Festival played 18 queer films in June. The year before they played 14. The year before that they played 11. And there's also the aspect of Netflix. Like there seems to be a lot of films. What will happen is they'll play the Northern Hemisphere sort of summer, spring sort of circuit, and then they'll just want to sell to Netflix, and that's kind of their MO. They kind of just, instead of travelling the festival circuit for a year for 18 months, they kind of just only want to do it for like 6 to 9 months now.
And that doesn't lock up their rights.
So it means you can miss out on films.
Yeah.
Sorry?
It locks up their rights. They're not allowed to send it off to a festival once they're secured a sale on those platforms.
I think sometimes they are. I think it depends, but it's more so the fact that, you know, we want to play things that... you know, can't get an audience in another way. So, I mean, we do play films that have sold to Netflix. It depends on the film, though. So if it's a really big film, we might do it. But some films, we're just like, well, that just takes away our audience. So we can't justify playing it. It's on a case-by-case basis.
And now that we've gone down this rabbit hole, Lisa, I did want to ask, because it comes up quite often with, particularly with our queer film festivals here in Australia. And, you know, looking at the program here, I think you've escaped it, really, but often it will happen that a queer film festival will put their program out, and at the same time, some streaming service, maybe it's SBS On Demand, maybe it's ABC iView, they put up, like, you know, a number of films that are in the program, and that hasn't happened with this year's program, but it does happen quite often. Is there some kind of, like, do they have to disclose if they're selling to someone else, or how does that happen?
Oh, it's a complicated, it's a very complicated thing. It seems to be, again, things are changing in the way that streaming is changing the world. I pulled one film that they didn't tell me during the whole negotiation process that it was already available on iTunes, and it's been unavailable on iTunes since, I think it's like September or something. They was like, we should have had this conversation in the first place. And I'm like, well, I expect if I'm communicating with you that you would actually say, oh, just so you know. And I have had a few filmmakers or sales agents say that, just sort of say, look, so you know it's going to be on ABC iView from this date or it's going to be on X. And then you can actually make an informed decision about whether you want to actually program the film. It's difficult, though, when you don't have the information to be able to make an informed decision. And you don't want to be so... I mean, I probably just need to be more obvious and literally just say, is this not online? And then, you know, and then I can cover it off at the beginning.
Lisa, I think you're very generous, because most filmmakers should be aware of that when they are selling their films out. I say this as someone who did the short circuit.
As a filmmaker yourself.
You have to be mindful of that when you are sending out to a festival which region you're in. So, you know, I think you're being very kind. But I think there is a particular audience. Like, even though I know something is going to be on a free-to-air platform, I love going to watch a film with my community in that sort of setting. Go and have a drink and chat about it later. I mean, you're playing Desert Hearts, which it is a rites of passage film for lesbians. You kind of need to go and see that on the big screen and then chat about it with your friends after. I mean, everyone's got the DVD, but I bet you're going to have a sellout cinema.
It's selling pretty well, actually. We do retrospectives every year, and it's probably selling... in terms of the lesbian films generally never sell as well as the boy films, unfortunately. But it's probably selling the best of any lesbian retrospective we've done.
Can I ask, why is that, Lisa? Because
it drives me mad.
Surely it's not. Surely is it the fact that there are more gay men attending film festivals than there are lesbian women? Or surely it's not to do with the kind of gender balance, is it?
I think there's a few. I mean, I haven't. Someone, you know what? Someone should probably do a PhD on that. But I think, I mean, it's the case in the point with anything. The fact that women stereotypically don't have as much disposable income as men, and, you know, it's not like a a cheap thing to be immerse yourself in a film festival.
No.
That's one thing. Often women of a certain age will often have children, and in a lesbian relationship, it's like you have to have a babysitter then, and are you going to be able to go to the movies? You might go and see one film, whereas the guys might go and see four films.
Yeah.
And so it tends to find that we get a lot of women who only come and see one film, and we try and encourage them to come to more. And we did have a festival 2 years ago. We do a smaller festival in September called Queer Screen Film Fest, and we actually... in that particular festival, we actually had more women come than men to that smaller festival that runs for like 5 days, which was really impressive. Unfortunately, the trend has not continued, but there's just not as much content as well that gets made for women.
Oh, you've got some amazing films this year, though. I am desperately hanging to watch Signature, the movie.
Oh, it's a great movie.
It looks amazing.
It's so good, and it is really good, and it's so diverse. You know, it's a very unique story. It's not something that I've personally ever seen before from a lesbian film.
What is Signature?
It's about Move? It's called Signature Move, and it's by a Muslim American woman, and it's just about her and her mother, and obviously she hasn't come out to her mother, and it's about the relationship two of them have, but it's also she meets a very passionate and very confident Mexican lesbian who has a very different relationship with her family, and they kind of have a one-night stand that kind of turns into something else, and then it's just really fun, but it also has incredible heart, and there's also wrestling.
Yes, lesbian. Like I've been following the filmmaker because I've seen some of her other stuff, and I love that they are unapologetic. That there isn't any kind of, you know, it's, you know, there aren't any characters that are just desperately miserable throughout the film. They
are we going to recognise any of her other films?
I think more the short work that we've sort of seen. So I'm looking. I just want to get my hands and see this film.
Yeah,
looks absolutely delightful. I can't wait. So girls, get your tickets to that.
Well, I'm just thinking, is it Desert Moves? Is that the Desert Hearts?
No, Desert Hearts.
And the thing
Desert Hearts.
The wrong film to get wrong.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry, sorry, Lisa.
But this is a digital restoration. It's a 4K digital restoration. And so this film was made in 1985 and it's set in 1959. And it looks incredible. The way the restoration's been done, I saw it when I was at Frameline in San Francisco. And it's just such good film. And I work in an office. We have a bunch of volunteers and interns and things that come into the office, and most of them are about 23, and none of them have seen it. So I'm like, it's terrible.
So that begs the question, have you actually programmed the senior shorts to play after this particular film so you get the same crowd?
No.
Can I say, we were all super excited to see you've got a senior short package. Well done.
Totally.
Thanks.
Complete.
It's good. It's really good because it's important to see different faces on screen. Not only people of colour, not only different genders, not only different races, but to see different ages on screen. Because so much of what gets programmed and so much of what gets made is about young people or people who are around 20, 30, 40. Like, it's just rare to get films made about people who are over 40. So, I just wanted to do a focus on it and do a short package, which was good.
And we would like to see more of it, especially seeing as though I'm moving into that demographic. No, seriously.
It's
really
Fox.
Important for us to see ourselves on screen.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And the thing is like, you know, as we've just been saying, a lot of these films are pitched very much at a younger, with younger actors, a younger audience. And you know what? Our community is so much more diverse than that. And so this is why I think we particularly like these senior shorts packages and any other senior films that would come along.
It's, you know, for me as well, in terms of like representing the community, there's a film that I'm showing called The Ring Thing. We showed a film that these filmmakers made a couple of years ago called That's Not Us. And the thing that I like about this film is this is a two guys who I'm guessing are in their early 30s, possibly late 20s, and they're married and they're from New York and they met at film school, I think. And they are making films about people who are, you know, late 20s, early 30s, late 30s, who are queer, but are in long-term relationships. And they're doing that because they just don't see films about people in our community who are in long-term relationships. And it's true. The amount of films that I see that are about people either hooking up or meeting someone for the first time or have nothing to do with that at all. But it's just, you just rarely see non-documentaries, you rarely see narrative features that are about people who are in established relationships and it's got nothing to do with cheating and it's just about something that's happening in their lives. And if they're going to be here, they're running the masterclass. They make a really interesting style of film as well, where it's, I wouldn't say it's mumblecore, but they do a thing where it's a lot of this, a little bit improvisational. And because it's drama, it's quite different to have improvisational drama than it is comedy. And this particular film in itself also has a documentary element to it as well, where they're actually making a real life documentary, because it's a thing of, you know, we have same sex marriage now, and yes. What happens after that? We have exactly. We have same sex divorce, and so it kind of looks at that. And because it's in America and they're a couple of years ahead of us, they actually go and interview people who've gotten divorced, and people who contemplated getting divorced, and people who got married, and at the same time it's these two characters experiencing the thing of, do they want to marry their partner, and that pressure because you now can get married.
What I know for some of us, what we love most about the festival is, one, seeing our films with our community, but it's also the events that we get to, yep. You know, because it's not just seeing a film. It's sometimes speed dating and seeing a film. Sometimes it's, you know, maybe for a filmmaker, it's a speed networking for filmmakers. Can you tell us some yep. of the events that are coming up?
Well, there are two of them you've just mentioned. We have speed dating for two Fridays in a row, the girls speed dating and the boys speed dating. We did it for the first time last year and people loved it. It was super fun. I don't know if there were any love matches that happened out of it. I know there was a couple of, perhaps not love, but other things.
yes, they became movie reviewers, possibly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Facebook friends.
So that's a super fun thing. And then we have a couple of filmmaker things. So there's the masterclass that I was speaking of. And then we do have we do it at each of our festivals. We have what's called a speed networking thing for local filmmakers. And we just kind of get them down. And we're doing a thing where it's like producer meets, like a director seeking a producer or a writer seeking a producer. And so we've got the girls from Jade of Death who are going to be down there talking about how they met and how to have a functional relationship as a producer and with a writer and various other things. And then people just kind of get together afterwards and literally have name tags saying I'm a whatever seeking something else, which should be really helpful, hopefully, for the local filmmakers. And then we've also got a really cool thing happening just before Desert Hearts, actually, which is a little while ago, I think it was in September, we did, because it's our 25th Mardi Gras Film Festival, we decided to put out a survey to anyone who cared to fill it in about what is their favourite quiz song of all time.
We're on your webpage at the moment, and there are a number of pictures here. Mm-hmm. Are these the films that have been voted the top?
They possibly could be.
They could be.
They might be, or maybe it's a mystery.
Because can I say, if these are, congratulations, because I'm seeing some of these films there, Call Me By Your Name, Weekend.
Very recent. I think people are forgetting, though.
My Beautiful Laundrette.
My Beautiful Laundrette's there.
Oh, I'm looking. Really great. Oh, a single... are we giving too much weight?
I'm looking for the Wedding Banquet. I can't see the Wedding Banquet in there. Is the Wedding Banquet? I can't see the screen.
The Wedding Banquet's not in that image, no. It may be in the top. I don't know. I can't reveal it. All will be revealed.
There's one or two that I can't pick. It's like, well, this is very exciting. So what's the event?
Are they lesbian films? No.
Yeah, of course they are. That's why I'm
here.
Well,
there's very few lesbian films in this list, to be honest.
Desert Hearts is front, right in the middle, it's and right Blue there, is not the warmest colour.
And Carol is there.
Does that count as a lesbian film?
Yes,
we've had this discussion. I don't think so.
Help me, Lisa.
There's a few. There's a few lesbians. There are a few lesbian films. I actually, when we did it, it was interesting because I was really amazed with how many different films were people's top. We actually gave people the option of choosing three films because it's too hard to choose one. Mm-hmm. And also because I wanted to try and have some diversity, because in all honesty, I was worried that we wouldn't have any lesbian films or any trans films or anything in the list. So I wanted to try and broaden it. But it was really interesting. I think we had I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it was just a ridiculous, there were like 200 different films people chose as their favourite.
Wow, that's incredible.
And I remember one of my board directors said to me, they're like, I think you need to do this in categories because you're just going to end up with the same five films. And I was like, no, I had 200 different film
fabulous.
Names.
Fabulous.
Which, you know, just goes to show the diverse range that people have in their taste, and that you're never going to please everyone with a film, and that's why you need to show diversity in a film festival.
Well, one thing's for sure. I'm sure that session will have some robust discussion about what was included and what wasn't.
Please stream it for the Melbourne audience, because we'd love to tune in. Sold out already? Is it all?
I'm astounded. I was actually astounded that it's sold out. We had like 70 people say they're coming. So it's amazing. So hopefully it should be fun. I'm doing it with two local people who are very well known in Sydney for being film connoisseurs, and it should be a fun. It should be fun.
Well, if they're busy, you can always fly Daniel, myself, and Alan up, and we'll happily veto some of those
films.
You're
welcome to fly up and join. I can't pay, but you're welcome to come up.
Look, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Lisa. As a way of wrapping up, if you had to pick one kind of underdog from the program that you'd like people to go and see, what's the one kind of underdog film that you'd recommend?
Oh, an underdog. That's a good question. What an underdog. I've been saying my favorite film is a short film, which is called Little Potato. I've watched probably 400 films this year, and it's by far my favorite film. It's just so entertaining, and I would have played it in front of every session if I could, but I couldn't. I'm playing it like four times, just because it's such an amazing film.
This is Little Potato. Little Potato, did you?
Little Potato, yeah. It's about, it's just a 14-minute documentary about a gay guy and his mum who are from Russia. And just what happens to them when they decide to emigrate to America. And it's just 14 minutes of surprises and joy, and it just ramps up every single time. And you literally just burst out laughing all the time, and you just can't believe the stuff that happened to them in their lives. So it's very entertaining.
Okay. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us, Lisa. People who want to find out more about the program can, of course, go to, is it queerscreen.org.au?
That is it.
Okay, queerscreen.org.au for tickets and more about the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
No, my pleasure.
One film that I'm really looking forward to is Hello Again, which is this kind of fabulous new musical. So I think now's as good a time as any to kind of sample that soundtrack. This is Audrey McDonald. Do you remember her from Beauty and the Beast? She was the chest of drawers.
She was the chest of... she was the armoire.
Madame Amour. So this is Madame Amour with Beyond the Moon from the new musical movie Hello Again, which is screening as part of this year's Mardi Gras Film Festival. You are, of course, listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
You, my love,
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where we are celebrating the Mardi Gras. Oh, look, the song's starting again. We don't need to listen
please
to
no.
it.
No.
Yeah, end
not
it.
Again.
No, oh, turn it off.
I thought it was never going to end.
I
sorry,
really...
Sorry, Daniel, please.
I was trying... As I was saying, we're spotlighting the Mardi Gras film Fest, and I really love that song. I really like it. That's Audrey McDonald with Beyond the Moon from the musical movie Hello Again, which is screening as part of the film festival.
I think they kind of call songs like that a sleeper. Is that what they call them, a sleeper?
Or
it's
a grower.
Bit of a Groundhog Day
a
kind of song.
Yeah, you actually have
can
to
I say
to it
I really like that song? Mm-hmm. Really like it. Okay. And if you know, if you're hungry for some more Audrey after that song, as I think we all are, why not take a listen to the Beauty and the Beast soundtrack?
Yeah, I think I'll listen to that Disney one again. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, much better. Mm-hmm. Hey, we've had a message in. We've had a message in from a David. And, you know, David's sort of picking up on some of the conversation that we had with Lisa in the previous segment. And he said, I know this is mainstream, but an example of a long-term gay relationship is the new Star Trek on Netflix. Now, I can comment on this because I've actually watched Star Trek Discovery. I've watched the entire season.
Have
and
you?
it is marvelous. I mean, it is remarkable.
You're talking about Anthony Rapp.
I am talking about Anthony Rapp.
Yeah, right.
And you actually do have a genuine representation of a gay couple on Star Trek. I mean, you know, they actually kiss, they hold hands, and it's a true relationship, and it is remarkable. So, you know what? Kudos to Star Trek Discovery. So,
if you want to message in and join this conversation this evening, you can message in on 0427JOY949, or you can email us at onair@joy.org.au. We are, of course, spotlighting the Mardi Gras Film Festival. It kicks off later this week. And to celebrate, we have, of course, just spoken with festival director Lisa Rose. And right after this, we're going to be speaking with Ian Thomas Ash, who is the producer of a really interesting documentary, Boys for Sale, which takes us into the underground world of sex work in Japan. More on Outtakes coming up right after this.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are spotlighting the Mardi Gras Film Festival ahead of its beginning later this week, the 15th of February, which has crept up on us.
Mm.
Well, one of the documentaries, which I was absolutely blown away by it. It is really difficult viewing, but brilliant viewing. You really will be immersed in the story, is Boys for Sale, which is basically about the sex trade. Well, I hate saying the word boys sex trade in Japan.
Mm. But well, because that's, none of the sex workers that the documentary spotlights are supposed to be under 18.
None are under 18. And when they interview the men on screen, they all claim to be 19 to 30.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And I don't think there is anyone younger. I mean, mm-hmm. the 19, I'm kind of
a bit dodgy. That
a bit dodgy there. but it is really, it's really difficult stuff to watch.
Why did you find it difficult to watch?
I think even though, it is what we're seeing on screen. These are people who are desperate and not doing sex work because
they enjoy it.
They enjoy it. Not many do. Many kind of talk about how they have to, their first experience, their most extreme experience, how they kind of deal with that sort of stuff, because many of the men that were interviewed claim to be straight and have mm-hmm. girlfriends and mm-hmm. and why they got into this trade. It might have been a debt, might not have been their debt. There was a tsunami victim in one of them. So there were, you know, really like we sort of learn everyone's kind of journey into this work and people that have, you know, apparently retired and now managing other people in this industry. Mm. So it is really, it's a story I've never seen from this viewpoint. I loved the use of manga to show the more explicit parts of the story that weren't, you know, that were recreated using manga to tell those stories. So I really love seeing that style of cinema on screen.
That was great from this documentary point of view.
It was brilliant. The soundtrack was amazing. It was just quite beautiful to tell a really difficult story.
Without the manga, without the animation, this film would have been incredibly dull, really, in that sense. I mean, that really brought it to life. I mean, you were able to, you didn't really have to use too much of your imagination, but it added to that, didn't it?
Yeah.
I thought the film was a film of paradox, really, because they preface the film by saying that Shinjuku to Chrome is the largest gay community in the world. They go on to say that they say that this is the biggest gay city anywhere in the world. Yet in Japan, the idea of homosexuality is still very much not talked about. Yeah. So here we have this extreme. We have the largest gay community in the world, but it's not really acknowledged. It's swept under the carpet.
Well, I sat down with Ian Thomas Ash, who is the producer of this film. It's directed by Taco, who doesn't speak English. So so I sat down with Ian Thomas Ash, and we had a chat about this fascinating new documentary.
You know, I heard about these bars where these very young men, really some of them just teenagers, were working as sex workers, and it was something that it was certainly not coming from a place of judgment. It was coming from a place of wanting to or trying to understand how they were working.
The idea of these bars where you go and you select a sex worker off the menu is just kind of so foreign to the way that sex work would take place, I think, somewhere like Australia. So it's really some of the practices associated with sex work in this district are just fascinating and so foreign to us here in Australia.
There are some very, very, you can only say Japanese qualities or aspects to the way that they're actually working.
Sex is so taboo in Japanese culture, and yet having these bars is such an open act. It seems so incongruous.
It's really interesting because one of the sections of the film kind of addresses this red light or the former red light district where these bars are located. And it's actually, for centuries, has been known as a location for a destination for sex. And yeah. So, quote unquote, you know, good people would not necessarily go to those areas. And so even though it is public and it is on the street, it's not a road that maybe people traditionally would have walked down. And so they are kind of opening, they are kind of operating in the open. And yet because it's an area that people, you know, maybe it's been considered quite seedy or for whatever reason, they tend not to go there.
Well, I guess that underground dimension, that underground aspect goes a considerable way to explaining why so many of these sex workers are so ill-informed about issues like, for instance, STI, sexually transmitted infections, like HIV.
Yes, it was something that was really shocking for all of us. And it was something that we kind of, when we were doing the research phase, sort of came to understand that was probably the case. But when we sat down and the interviews were filmed, really everyone in the room, both during the filming and also coming back and during the editing process, were all very affected by that and really felt very strongly that that was a theme that we wanted people to think about.
Well, what in particular about that scene did you want people to think about? Why did you want people to reflect on that?
I think it's easy for people to sort of say, well, you know, we're not talking about people that have been trafficked, and so they ostensibly have a choice to enter the sex trade. And yet, through their lack of knowledge and through the circumstances in which they are living, which have in many cases caused them to enter sex work, I would suggest that they don't truly have a choice, and that they don't have the information with which to make an educated choice. And so, I think we're not talking about the kind of in the West, maybe we tend to think more about sex work as being work and that it's a career choice and that sex workers are trained and know how to protect themselves and know how to protect their clients. You know, we're really not talking about that kind of situation. People sometimes get into a situation where they can't always just walk away. It's easy for us to say, well, if you're in danger and you're uncomfortable, then don't do it. But it's not always that easy.
I mean, I think the documentary is so fascinating in how it explores why a lot of the sex workers that it interviews have turned to sex work.
Yes, I think, again, we weren't trying to sort of, make a judgment against the sex industry or to present stories, you know, that were disproportionately, negative. As you mentioned, there were a couple of the guys had come from the area that was destroyed after the 2011 earthquake and tsunami and nuclear meltdown. And they're part of a vulnerable group, which I wasn't really kind of aware of. You know, you think about vulnerable groups of people, say after a natural disaster or after a war, and typically we think about women, particularly young girls. It didn't occur to me really that young that very young boys or young men would also be quite vulnerable.
And I think that kind of circles back to this kind of fundamental educative aspect of the documentary, and it is so enlightening in its representation of sex work in Japan, but also of Japanese culture, I think, more broadly. And I did wonder, obviously, you were finding out about these young men that they didn't know about things like HIV, and a lot of them have poor understandings of their own rights and self-worth. I wonder, did the filmmaking team on this project see fit sometimes? Did you ever kind of educate them about their rights or about HIV, or was it purely, was the filmmaking process purely an extrapolation of their lived experience?
Another really wonderful question. I mean, first to address the filmmaking team. So, those guys were all being, of course, they were all being interviewed in Japanese. And in one interview in particular, about sexually transmitted diseases, you will see that, as you know, in the film, one of the guys isn't really clear kind of what it is that's being talked about. In fact, he does not possess the vocabulary in his native language to be able to have an adult discussion about what a sexually transmitted disease is and how you get it.
Yeah.
Although he's a sex worker who's working in the sex trade. And so it's so devastating to know that, you know, here's somebody who can't even really have this kind of detailed conversation. And so your next question, which is to re-educate them, that's a question that sort of we, as filmmakers, we come across a lot, you know, where is the line between being a filmmaker and an activist, and how do you deal with that? And it's something that we need to think about and that we should think about. But I will admit to you that as a team, you know, when you're dealing with somebody who doesn't really have the vocabulary, how does one even begin to educate them when they don't even know what an STD is? How can you sort of quickly and, you know, sort of in the time that we have, be able to do that? And I must also admit that none of us, you know, on the executive team, you know, feel sort of qualified to educate a sex worker, you know, in how to protect themselves.
Ian Thomas Ash there, the producer of Boys for Sale, which screens as part of this year's Mardi Gras Film Festival.
Controversial question there, Daniel, asking a documentarian to interrupt and to participate in the story there. Don't know how I...
Was that a question or was it a statement? It?
Yeah, I think it's a little...
No, I mean your question.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I take the point.
Mm-hmm. And it's that, like, do you... But this is not like a wildlife documentary. This is...
We're not protecting the little baby elephant.
It's a question, isn't it? Like, does the filmmaker have a responsibility when he or she stumbles across something that is unjust or unfair or otherwise not right to the filmmaker?
He's attracted to the story because of all of that.
Yes,
that is the story he's telling.
But does the filmmaker go capture the story, come back and profit from it? Or do they actively work to affect change if they think that change is necessary?
I think they actively affect change by telling that story and taking it to a broader audience. In the story, you will actually see the educators that are on the ground that are really the people. They're not going to get advice about STD and STIs and safe sex from a foreigner that's coming to exploit them. Mm. Not exploit them in a bad way, but tell their story. Yep. They're going to get it from their peers, and they're the people we see in the film in there filling the condom dispensers, telling those, they're the real people that are going to educate each, they're going to educate each other. An external filmmaker who's there to just capture 20 men is not going to make a difference. I think.
Look, there's no doubt that it's a fascinating,
it should make a difference,
powerful documentary. You can catch it at this year's Mardi Gras Film Festival. More on the festival, including our interview with the director of A Moment in the Reeds, another really interesting film, coming up right after this. You're listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we've been spotlighting the Mardi Gras Film Festival, which kicks up in Sydney later this week.
And this is a story along the same lines of God's Own Country, in that
the next film that we're looking at.
The next film.
This film, so A Moment in the Reeds. A Moment in the Reeds is the film that we're talking about now. We've just looked at Boys for Sale, which was the film from Itako that chronicles the underworld of sex work in Japan. Really interesting. And moving now to a different continent, an entirely different culture, Finland. The film is A Moment in the Reeds, and it's from Mikko Mikaela.
That's right, and it's...
So now that we've done the introduction to the film, we can talk about the film.
We talked about the film. But, you know, I guess, you know, Gina and I, when we were commenting on this film, we really didn't feel as if it had a lot to offer.
I feel bad saying that.
Wow, harsh, Alan.
And do you think it's because we have seen now a couple of stories?
God's Own Country.
God's Own Country. But even that son-father, you know, out kind of relationship, we've kind of seen these stories a little bit now. And some of those stories have left us really hopeful.
Did they feature very good-looking blonde Finnish men?
Well, they all feature really good-looking men in the films that we've kind of seen.
I mean, that's almost the point, isn't it?
Oh, no.
But I shouldn't be.
No, I think because what we've got here is we've got a disapproving father who is homophobic, doesn't
You'll
it?
Get
doesn't
it in the first 2 minutes.
Doesn't really relate to his gay son. And, and so we've got this dynamic of the gay son coming home, visiting home, and then we have seen this story play out
but
a number
of times.
But
the interesting element, and yes, it does feel like God's Own Country a little bit, is that the love story here that is the subject of the film is a love story between a young Finnish man and a Syrian refugee.
Yeah.
Right? So this is very fresh and novel and of the times, this questioning about immigration and what's happening in Syria, though it's not really addressed by the film. This kind of question of the kind of confluence of cultures is novel, I think.
And you know, to go along with that, I think what we see here is we see a gay Syrian man leaving Syria because that environment is way too conservative. Mm. And he rocks up in Finland where he feels that it's much more open.
And he wants to make a go of this country and fall in love with this country.
And that's right, where he's free to be himself. Yet we have this young Finnish man who leaves Finland because he feels that Finland is too constrictive for him and too inhibitory, and he goes to Paris. So we've got this juxtaposition. I mean, like, where is the grass? Is the grass greener?
I think what we're seeing, this is a film about the marginalization and otherness that comes with being part of a minority group. And this is the kind of thread that ties them together. So we had a chat with Mikko Mikaela about his new film, A Moment in the Reeds, and we had a chat about exactly why he chose to meditate on these themes.
Well, exactly like you said, Finnish cinema hadn't really dealt with these subjects almost at all, and I really felt that it was time for it to tackle these issues and to provide representation. So I had... for many years I had wanted to make the first queer film in Finland because I was always surprised that even in a country that has a fairly progressive legislation and a fairly progressive society, or at least likes to think of itself as fairly progressive, that there hadn't been any feature films with lead gay characters. Mm. But then I also felt that really the experience of different minorities, sexual minorities and ethnic minorities is really linked as well. And I wanted to combine the two themes in this film and show how, especially in today's world and with the political situation being what it is, with all the right-wing politics popping up everywhere as well, how important it is for both sexual minorities and ethnic minorities to have solidarity between the groups and against the common enemy of intolerance. Mm. And so we shot the film about 18 months ago. It was in the summer of 2016. That was just following 2015, which was, I think, about the peak of the refugee crisis in Finland as well. We had seen a huge number of arrivals from Syria and Iraq, and there was a lot of xenophobic rhetoric going around in society. So I really wanted to try to tackle that with the film as well.
You know what? I think from what the director is saying, I think he was successful in bringing out some of that story of what refugees really suffered in terms of his journey from Syria through to Finland.
On a thematic level, in terms of representing the solitude of being a refugee, I think the film does explore solitude in its own way. Let's not forget that this is a debut film from a filmmaker working in a country which until last year had never produced a queer film.
Yep.
Mind-boggling.
Cinematically, it's beautiful as well. So this is gorgeous.
Like, if we take that into account and like how revolutionary this actually is for Finland. You know, obviously we had Tom of Finland last year. That was the two of them are two of three queer films to have been made in Finland for the first time last year. It is a feat. And yes, it does revisit territory that we're a bit used to. Mm-hmm. But
that's not the film's fault. And it's just bad timing. I think it is actually that.
Yeah, bad.
Yeah, and we're watching this behind another great film.
But it did have a trope, Gina, that you were not familiar with.
What, the daddy trope?
No.
You came up on another one. Because we're seeing the father trope. Starting to be the next coming of age trend here.
Yeah, we are actually.
I think we're really talking about the top bottom trope here. You know,
yeah, we've got
the
a
idea.
Minute to go to see how I missed this in this film, and obviously lots of gay male films.
So I think often what you'll see is you'll find that the smaller, pretty part. Member of that
you're
couple.
Struggling there, Alan,
it's
aren't you?
Often
help him,
the bottom,
help him, Daniel.
And so what we have here is we've got this young, pretty blonde, young, slight, pretty blonde, blonde, juxtaposed against a bigger, hairier, darker Syrian man. And ordinarily, you would see that trope where we've got the Syrian man would be the top, and the blonde would be the bottom. But in this film, we actually start to see some versatility occurring here.
No, because the trope is that the sex roles will change, and you see this in heterosexual films about heterosexual relationships as well. Sex roles change based on some profound character arc, and I personally think the trope is a little bit tired. But
I think we need a show on this because we're down to like 10 seconds.
Okay, we're not going to cover the trope in the next 10 seconds. But what we do have time to do is to say thank you to Lisa Rose for joining us on the program tonight, Festival Director of Queer of the Mardi Gras Film Festival. Thank you to Louise Nylon at the festival who helped us put the show together. Big thank you to the two filmmakers who joined us this evening, Mikko Mikaela and Ian Thomas Ash. And we have officially run out of time. That's it for another episode of Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.